let's get going so that you can get up there to get seated for Cafe Holden. For those of you who are new here to Holden today or have attended one of my sessions for the first time, I'm Laura Jungling. I have been here all week. This is the last session I will be teaching here at Holden this time around anyway. I'm from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I teach at Augustana College in the religion department. My primary area is ethics. And I discovered Bonhoeffer again. I've read him before, but discovered him again about a year and a half ago, and I've really been reading up a storm, so to speak, and really got into what he was saying this time around for my own research, for a class I'm teaching on campus, and just for thinking about a different way of doing ethics beyond just your typical rules and regulations and controversies. Today, we're going to talk about, there will be more of those sheets coming, by the way. They're still copying. The copy machine is extremely slow. So today, what we're going to talk about, we've been asking some questions all week. We've been asking questions about what is community and what ought community be, who ought to be in the community, and who isn't in the community, and why, and how do you get in? What does it mean to live together in the community, and what does it mean to live together with those outside of the community, or rather, with society as a whole? Today, we're going to ask a slightly different question. How many of you think the world is changing? Kind of stupid question, huh? Of course it's changing. So the larger question is, what does it mean? You can just pass it, send it out. I've already passed mine. Thanks, Chris.
You don't get one? They're coming around.
What does it mean to live in a community that is changing? What does it mean to live ethically or live out what ought we do and be in a community that is changing? And specifically with regard to Bonhoeffer, what does it mean to be a disciple of Christ in a community that is changing? And that community is both the church, or the community of Christ, as well as the larger world. So, to start with, what I'd like us to do is just brainstorm. This should be an easy task. It would be a long one if I let you go all the time. But what are some of the changes that are happening both in our culture, our world, as well as in the Christian church? What are some of the changes that you see and that are happening?
Equality for all on the way.
Equality for all is happening. Yeah, yeah. I mean, more and more Christian churches are allowing women to be ordained. More and more, we have equality of people of different races. Although the church, the Christian church, is still one of the most segregated institutions in the United States of America, for a variety of different reasons. But nonetheless, within these churches, those that have people of different races and ethnicities are more and more experiencing them as equal. Certainly in the ELCA and other mainstream denominations, the question of gay and lesbian rights and equality is becoming much more of a reality. More equality. Another.
I think a lot more fear since Dinah.
A lot more fear, yes. Generally, in our country, in our world, and even in our churches, we are indeed a nation, and particularly the Western world, that is filled with fear and anxiety and worry.
Mm-hmm. Economics: the rich are richer, the middle class is shrinking, the lower class is increasing.
Yeah.
More hunger.
Yeah. Our economic situation is changing. Now, economic situations are always in flux, But right now, we begin to see the differential between the rich and the poor, and the middle class is slowly heading towards a lower class or poor category. So economics, and that adds to the fear and anxiety, right? If I'm not one of those that has plenty of money and plenty of resources, and I can't find a job, or I have a low-paying job that doesn't provide benefits, I'm worried, I'm afraid, particularly if I have a family that I'm trying to help support. What else is going on? Yeah,
technology has changed the way of communicating.
Yes, technology. I mean, just, I think about Holden, and the last time I was here, there was no way we could get email. Now, granted, it's minimal, and it's only reserved for certain situations, but satellite phones and that sort of thing make it possible for communication that wasn't possible. There was a story a number of years ago when I was here, when you guys were here, where the guy had to, got a call, found out some way that he got an interview for a job while he was coming up to Holden. So he got up here and he had, of course, no way to call them, no way to email them, nothing. And so what he did is he climbed up to Copper Basin, and then up on the saddle between the peaks up there, and he had a cell phone, and he was able to get a cell phone signal, and he had his interview via cell phone.
But did he get the job?
And I think he got the job. I can't remember that for sure. But, I mean, you got to admire the guy's tenacity to be willing to do that. And, you know, now he might be able to, you know, do something via email, at least to postpone or something like that. Technology for communication, yeah.
People are moving and going in a lot more places than they've been able to go.
Yes. Yeah, the ability to move around, to visit places, to travel to places. People are living lifestyles where they are split households. The husband lives here in this city, and because that's where he can find a job, and the wife lives over here in this city because that's where she can find a job. And I know of people like this who are trying to maintain a relationship, and it's not just heterosexual couples. Gay and lesbian couples are doing the same thing, just trying to be able to live and function. And so they meet on weekends and have a marriage that way, or a relationship that way. But our ability to travel is huge, yeah. Uh-huh.
Our family structure is becoming less and less of a norm.
Yeah, we're having a different, new forms of family are emerging, right? Families where they are so blended you can't tell, it from the outside. Those who are in this inside know who's related to who, but you come in, well, he's my stepdaughter on this side, and kids have four sets of grandparents instead of two, and, family structure is changing.
I think we have a feeling that our world is getting smaller even more, because we can be less isolated. There's more things that make us connected to, like, say, financial situation in Greece,
yeah,
or the situation in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we started feeling that more with 9/11, but
uh-huh,
it's even more so, like having knowing that we have coal ash from China landing on us here in Washington State.
Yeah.
And things like that. Our world is seeming smaller. You can't isolate yourself anymore.
Right.
Like you could,
uh-huh,
100, 200, 300 years ago, we all felt like we could all just be our little place.
Yeah, exactly. It is getting much smaller. And yet, some would argue, even as it's getting smaller, because of our communication, the way we communicate, we are pulling apart more because our communication is being done by text or on screen instead of face-to-face. As we get smaller, we also, in some ways, stretch relationships. So, yeah, good. Uh-huh.
And they tell us our mainline churches are losing members.
Yes. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about what is happening in the churches. mainline churches, those of who that have been the traditional, as they say, mainline center of the United States culture, are losing members rapidly in some cases. The Episcopalian Church is losing members just like crazy. The ELCA is dropping, but as are many of the others. What are some of the other things that are happening to the churches? That are the changes that are happening in your churches?
Mm-hmm. The color of a lot of the congregations are changing. There are more diverse.
Yes. Yeah, you can't go to church now and just have a bunch of Norwegians, right? Or just a bunch of Scandinavians. You gotta let the Germans in now, and you gotta the Scots, and you gotta let the the people from France or Mexico or other places. So diversity of all different types and shades are coming in. What else?
Churches are also, because of the drop in congregations, are joining, and two will join in a building.
Yeah.
And that creates all kinds of interesting things.
It sure does. Churches are finding new ways to survive, sharing pastors, sharing other forms of leadership, sharing buildings where they have to combine. I served a three-point parish out in rural South Dakota. It was a yoked parish, but after the vote in the ELCA, two of those churches split off and one remained in, so they had to rethink, all of them, how they were going to be either Lutheran or church Christian in the middle of South Dakota. Yeah.
Well, we have a problem that the older children and youth in our church have so many other activities and obligations that church is pretty much an afterthought.
Yeah.
And and they're gone.
Yeah. Yeah. The generational realities of church. If you go to most churches, mainline churches, it's a little different in the more evangelical churches and the Roman Catholic Church, simply because of the nature of those entities. It's largely older folks, who come. Now, there are certain churches that are very family-oriented, but trying to get them to participate in anything else than going to worship on Sunday can be a trick sometimes. Yeah.
Along with your last statement, we're discovering in our church, in our congregation, that more of the families and more of the people attend once, maybe twice a month, rather than three or four times a month. So they're still there, but they don't get involved in a person's in adult education, or even in youth education or Sunday school. If you want to plan something that lasts 3 weeks, some won't even sign up for it because they're not going to be here 3 weeks in a row.
Yeah, yeah. But just the busyness and the hecticness of our schedules and our lives are keeping people from participating the way. I mean, it used to be the church was the center of a community. That's where people got to know each other. That's where people gossiped about everything. That's where people... Yeah, but they don't have as many people to gossip about. it was where the community came together. Now that's just not the case anymore.
Mm-hmm. Our kids are into texting and social networking. Is there some way the church can adapt some of that?
Well, that's a great segue. Thank you. You're moving me into the next question I wanted to ask, and that question is, what are some of the ways the churches are responding to some of these changes and these issues? And what I'd like you to do is just turn to a partner and brainstorm about three different ways that you see either your church, your congregation, or the ELCA, or whatever larger member church you're a part of, how do you see the churches, the Christian churches, responding to the changes, both in the culture, you know, as well as within the church. So just find one or two people next to you and just brainstorm about three ways that churches are responding. Something that is very real for those of us in individual congregations, those of us as part of member churches. I'm going to mention four larger movements. I'm just going to briefly mention them. And the reason why we're talking about this, by the way, we will get to Bonhoeffer, is that he is writing what we're going to talk about today at a time, obviously, when the church is drastically changing. And in fact, he sees it changing so much, it's changing itself, or the world is changing it out of existence. And he's perfectly fine with it. And by church, I mean church as an institution, the Christian church as an institution. I don't mean Christianity or faith in Christ. Bonhoeffer clings to that. But as we'll see in a little bit, he believes that the church as an institution has run its course, given his experience and what's going on in Germany, in Europe, in the world at his time. He believes that basically the world has grown up and doesn't need religion anymore. That doesn't mean Christianity as a faith goes away, but as a religion it does. But we'll get to that in a second. Here are four major movements that are happening right now in our culture and around the world. You've certainly heard of this one. I put quotations around it because there is such thing as a fundamentalist church that has certain tenets or belief statements that you have to subscribe to. But this is used more generally, this movement towards much more rigidness, fundamentalism as being very rigorous, very conservative, and having certain holiness codes that you have to meet or you're not officially Christian, that kind of thing. So some people, in the face of all the changes both in our culture and our church, are turning to something that gives them a sense of order, a sense of peace, maybe, but certainly a sense of control. And it's understandable. When the world feels like chaos, some people need to have that sense that somebody or something is in control. And if everybody followed the rules and everybody lived this very rigid way, everything would be just fine. And so there are some who are turning more towards a conservative or fundamentalist approach to Christianity. And we see it in varieties of forms in our culture, but also around the world. Another one is what is called the liberal church. This is represented by folks like Marcus Borg, John Shelby Spong, other theologians who are questioning the way the church has traditionally thought about Jesus and its creeds and God and creation. But they're proposing new, more what might be called open or liberal or questioning responses to these. So they're not going to go that rigid route. They're going to go more, let's just kind of explore what the possibilities are. Now, for some people, that's just way too loosey-goosey. You know, but for others, the rigidness of the fundamentalist approach is much more confining, and they can't live in it, and so they turn to more of a liberal church approach. The third one I wanted to mention, skipping around, is the emergent church. I don't know if you've heard about this emergent church movement. It's actually coming out of the evangelical church, evangelical churches. Evangelical churches are a broad spectrum of churches. And it's ways that, it, as somebody said in the back, of using the culture, using the media, using the social media, using the varieties of different music and other things that is very cultural to be quote-unquote relevant, to reach people, particularly the youth, but not just the youth, to find ways that change how we do things in the Christian church to make it more contemporary. And it could be anything from a praise band to doing dramas in church on Sundays instead of sermons, or just all sorts of different things. They still hold to a fairly evangelical creed or approach to Christianity. But nonetheless, it's a way to take the culture and make it their own. Now, how many of you have heard this phrase, spiritual but not religious? I hear it all the time from my students. In a way, it's kind of understandable. You might have said the same thing when you went to college. You get to college, you realize that there are other things out there than what mom and dad and your pastor and your confirmation instructors taught you, and you start exploring. And suddenly you're not so sure about all this religious stuff. You're not so sure about the institution of the church, all of its rules and regulations and all of its practices, and the fact you have to go through confirmation to get communion, all these different rituals. I don't need any of that. I believe in God on my own. I'm spiritual. Jesus is my personal savior. I really don't care what he did on the cross. There are various forms of this. spiritual but not religious approach. This stems in some ways from a cultural reality that is happening, and that is a continuing distrust of institutions, distrust of all institutions, in part because these institutions have earned that distrust. You know, the government is not working so well right now at various levels. Our churches have let people down in varieties of different ways. Our education systems don't seem to be working as well as some would like. Our healthcare system is a mess, although in some places it's changing and trying to find new ways of being. A lot of the institutions that people relied on aren't trustworthy anymore. And when the youth see adults fighting and hating each other, as they have in the Christian churches, at least in our country, over the past 15, 20 years, you know, about sexuality, but also about race and other things, they go, I don't need that. I'll go practice by myself. I'll believe in God, and I'll walk through nature on Sunday. You know, I'll take a walk. Or I'll be with my friends. That's where I find my spirituality, where I find God. So these four are larger movements in our culture. This one right here is what I deal with daily. Occasionally this one, but this is the one that I am working with youth on, or college students on, figuring out where they are and what they believe. And it's not always easy, and sometimes I just have to let them be who they are and explore. That's what college is all about, just exploring what's out there and where they fit into that. Now, Bonhoeffer was experiencing a time of the Christian faith, obviously, when the whole world was falling apart. Germany and Great Britain were bombing each other into oblivion. The Russians were coming from the east and basically destroying everything after the Germans had gone east and destroyed everything first. Allies were coming from the south and the north. For Europe was basically being decimated. The church had either caved into the German, or into the Nazis, or it had basically just fallen away. There wasn't much left of it. Some of these folks who started out following Hitler, and they started to realize what he had done, he and the Nazis had done, tried to put, you know, their feet down and stop at least their own participation, but by then it was too late. They were stuck.
And that practically had to be underground, the confessing church.
Yes, and even the confessing church started to fall apart under pressure from the Gestapo and the Nazis. It was also... it wasn't just the two world wars, because remember, this is World War II, so there was one right before it that caused a whole lot of devastation and damage. And the church then was decimated as well. That there was a great deal of suspicion of the church and rejection of the church at the time, and there was this movement towards this, what was at the time a more liberal Christianity, a more spiritual but not religious approach. You might have heard of it. It was on the cover of Time magazine, I do believe. And that was the movement of God is Dead, the God is Dead movement. Now, people really didn't believe God was dead. What they believed was that the church, the Christian church, religion as a whole, was basically dead. The world didn't need religion anymore. In fact, religion was part of the problem. What people needed was reason. What they needed was good, solid legal systems and political systems. Democracy or something like that. Well, after World War II and the Cold War, people started to realize that even reason wasn't going to help. So we're kind of on a swing back into you know, a more religious environment, so to speak. It's a different type of religious environment, but nonetheless, we're swinging back. And that's, if you look at history, that's kind of what happens. It just pendulums. There are times where religion is much more active in cultures, and there are times when it's less active, and other things take its place in different ways. Now, that's what Bonhoeffer is seeing. Bonhoeffer is seeing his own church basically, you know, gave up the goose to Hitler. It was a farce as far as he was concerned. He was never really a religious man. His family didn't go to church on a regular basis. His father and his brother were agnostic. They didn't even know if they believed in God. And he, even after he decided to become a theologian and study theology, he didn't attend church regularly. He until he started serving as a pastor, then obviously you kind of have to be there. you got to show up if you're gonna serve as a pastor at a congregation. But going to church on Sundays, participating in the various activities of a church congregation, as a layperson, was never high on his radar. That has to do with a lot of different things in his life, as well as what was going on in the rest of the world. But so for him, the church in many ways was dead. It had killed itself, shot itself in the foot, really, by how it behaved. But also, it wasn't doing what it was supposed to, even in the good times and places. It wasn't fulfilling what it was supposed to be and do. And so Bonhoeffer, towards the end of his life, came up with this concept that is we know as religionless Christianity. Just a brief contextual note, this all comes from his letters and papers from prison. Now, there are other versions of this out there that are much smaller. Those versions of letters and papers from prison are one section of his letters that are particularly theological in nature. This edition took every letter they could find, not only the ones he wrote, but those that were written to him by his family members and friends, and put them in chronological order, starting from the time that he went to prison. All right. It also has some of his papers. You may not have heard in the film, but he didn't just write letters when he was in prison. He wrote fiction. He tried his hand at fiction. He wasn't very good at it. He even agreed that he wasn't very good at fiction, but it was his attempt to work out some of the things he was thinking about. He also wrote poetry, and he was quite good at poetry. And there is, in this text, some of his poems. The fiction is in another volume, but the poetry is in here. And again, you see him working out his... Poetry becomes a form for him of working out his own emotional, spiritual experience and feelings. He's trying to work through the fact that he's pretty sure now he's going to die. After about the first 6 months in prison, he realized that this was not going to be a quick process of trial and either convicted or released. It was going to be a long process, and more than likely he was going to die at the end of the process. And so, I mean, he's a human being. He's got to work through this. And so poetry was one of the ways he did so. And then, of course, he wrote part of his ethics, and he wrote other things. Some of his letters are just basic correspondence home. Dear Mom and Dad, I'm okay. You know, a lot of his letters to his fiancée and his parents were written to console and comfort and assure his family that he was doing okay, and that he would make it through. He didn't want to worry them. They were already worried. They were already being bombed by the Allies and had to go into bomb shelters every night. They already were worried about his brother and his brother-in-law. He didn't want them to worry about him too. But where you see his own worries and his own anxiety coming out is when he's writing to his friend, Eberhard Bethke. He's the one that wrote the biography. He's the one that put the letters and papers of prison together and the ethics together. He obviously did survive the war. The letters and papers from prison were the first things published after Bonhoeffer's death. Bethke published them within 3 years of his death. And they took the world by storm. Particularly this concept we're going to talk about a little bit, this religionless Christianity. It wasn't until later, much later, that the ethics were published, as well as discipleship and life together, as well as these other works. So this was the letters and papers were the first thing that people experienced by Bonhoeffer. Particularly the theological letters that he wrote. And by theological, I mean the ones there. He's still coming up with crazy theological ideas, sitting there in prison. As he's working out his own stuff, he's coming up with theological ideas. He writes to Bethke once, "I'm going to write a book. This is not ethics, this is a different book. I need to figure out what I mean by all this, but this is the outline of the book." And he lays it out. So, when you're in prison, it wasn't a work camp, other than being interrogated. And as far as we know, we know that Bonhoeffer was never tortured, unlike his brother-in-law and his brother and the other family members. Why that is, we're not really sure. But Bonhoeffer was interrogated quite harshly, but not tortured. And not put through physical pain. His other co-conspirators were. So that's just a little background. All of these letters that he wrote were written in Tegel prison, which is outside of Berlin. It was a military prison. Towards the end of his life, Bonhoeffer was moved to a different prison, also outside of Berlin, but a different side. At that point, his letters stop. They no longer are able to get letters out for him. Then from there, he's transferred to some of the concentration camps. They keep moving him from one to the next until they end up at Flossenbürg, where he was killed. But after he was moved out of Tegel prison, he was not allowed to communicate with anybody. And they weren't allowed to get any information either. There was even a point right before the last assassination attempt that he was considering escaping. He had a guard on his side, and he was going to try to escape. But when that assassination attempt failed, the climate became such that he decided, better not. His family would have been, gone. They would have gone after his family. It would have harmed them in order to find him. And so he decided not to try to escape. But there was a time where he considered. So what we're going to do now is just use the rest of the time to look at some quotations. And I put these quotations in order. Remember, one, he's writing out this thought process in letters. Two, this is not systematic. He didn't sit down, think through, okay, what is religionless Christianity, lay it all in outline form and sent it to his friend, Eberhard Bethke. He comes up with this idea, and then for the next months, he tries to work it out. And he's working it out in letter form. So what's really interesting is to follow. You'll see that I put after each quotation the date that he wrote that particular quotation and how he continues to work through this very strange concept of religionless Christianity. So we're not going to read all of these quotes, but I'm going to read. We're going to read some of them and just look at what you think he's trying to say. The fact of the matter, he never completed this. We are left with a half-finished idea. And so that's why it was so intriguing, I think, to people. Because they had this half-finished idea, and they got to play with it. They got to try to figure out what he meant. Remember, the problem for him, although he doesn't see it necessarily as a problem, is that basically religion is dead, or it should be dead. Religion is just causing more problems than it is helping. He doesn't want to lose Christianity or Jesus, but he does want to lose religion. So let's look first at this first quote. April 30th, 1944. He's been in prison about a year now. What keeps gnawing at me is the question, what is Christianity? Or who is Christ actually for us today? We are approaching a completely religionless age. People as they are now simply cannot be religious anymore. Is there such a thing as a religionless Christian? If religion is only the garb in which Christianity is clothed, and this garb has looked very different in different ages, what then is religionless Christianity? And given his metaphor of clothing, I inserted the word naked. What is naked Christianity? What is a Christianity without religion? Can we even fathom that idea? When we talk about religion, we talk about all the rituals, practices, orders, policies, all the stuff that makes up an institution. He wants to get rid of all of it. Even everything, even such things as the Apostles' Creed. The scripture, no. The scripture is different. That stays. But all of our extras, that he would call them, our ways of doing things in the church, our customs, our the order that we use to govern the church, all of it, he believes, is just causing more problems. And people don't need it. They don't want it, at least from his perspective. He's really working with a form of this spiritual but not religious. But it's not quite the same thing, as we'll see in a minute. So, what do you think when you hear this notion, religionless Christianity? Mm-hmm.
It's pretty easy to think, if you think of Bonhoeffer being in the position, the time when all of the church, or almost all of the church in Germany at that time, was supporting Hitler, or didn't have any choice, it was made to. And only the few in the confessing church have rejected that, but they had to be underground. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to understand him wanting to reject that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a little trickier to understand, like you said, like wanting to reject the Apostles' Creed, because that goes back, of course, much farther than anything else. So.
Yeah, all
that's,
of
that's more of a challenge to follow that.
All of the doctrine, all of the stuff that he in a way wanted to go back to an early church mentality. I say mentality, not way of doing things, but way of thinking. And
okay,
that meant way before the creeds. Certainly, scripture was part of it, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
So why not the way of doing things?
Say more.
Why not the way of doing things? You said just what the church believes. But the church is always doing something.
Yeah.
And it's doing a lot of good.
For him, it wasn't. For him, he wanted to get rid of the church entirely. At least that's the way I read it. The church is an institution, gone. And that we'll see it kind of develop. how he gets to where he gets. But basically, he wanted not only what it believed, but also its very existence as a human constructed institution. He believed it was useless. In fact, if we go down to quote number four, we can explore this a little bit. I consider the attack by Christian apologetics, apologetics are those who defend the faith or tradition, and they have been attacking the world's coming of age. Basically, Bonhoeffer believes the world has grown up. It's grown up to a point where it doesn't need religion anymore. And so he sees Christian apologetics attacking this idea of the world coming of age. He says, first of all, it's pointless. Second of all, it's ignoble. And third, it's unchristian. It's pointless because it appears to me like they're trying to put a person who has become an adult back into puberty. That is to make people dependent on a lot of things which, in fact, they no longer depend. To shove them into problems that are, in fact, no longer problems. Second, ignoble because an attempt is being made here to exploit people's weaknesses for alien purposes to which they have not consented freely. With regard to that statement, he goes on to say that it is akin to rape, what these apologetics are doing by forcing people to stay in the church. They're forcing people to do something, in his mind, that they have not consented to, by keeping them dependent on these doctrines, on the church, on the rituals, on all of these different things. Third, he says it's unchristian because it confuses Christ with a particular stage of human religiousness, namely with a human law. He wants to separate Christ from church as institution. This is radical stuff. This is part of the reason why I like Bonhoeffer, because he likes to play out there in radical land. Mm-hmm. He likes to explore. I don't know that I can go with him all the way here, but I can at least dance around in that corner with him to see where it can take us. And he believes that Christ, the person, the Son of God, is different than what any given church entity represents. So those of us in the Lutheran church, we don't own Christ. And Christ was not Lutheran, I'm sorry to say. He wasn't Catholic. He wasn't Presbyterian. He wasn't evangelical. He wasn't fundamentalist. He wasn't liberal. He was, in many ways, spiritual but not religious. To think about how he understood. He followed the Jewish faith, but he also challenged it. The difference between what Bonhoeffer's doing, or even Jesus, and what's happening in our culture, particularly with the youth, is spiritual but not religious is actually being used as a cop-out. It's more, I don't like it, so I don't want to participate. As opposed to, I actually do believe something really powerful, but the various churches don't represent that. A lot of times it's because they're just sick of the fighting. And so spiritual but not religious is an umbrella term. And so he was, I say that he was angry with his church, but in fact you can see some of this popping out before the Nazis even ever came on the scene. You can see it in his early stuff. Not to this extent, but it pops out in little pieces that he was already, before the Nazis came, thinking about what the church ought to look like. That was his dissertation, Sanctorum Communio.
Does custom discipleship show some of that?
I think so, probably the last part, yeah. Life together.
That was before. Right?
Uh-huh.
Dates of when he wrote.
Discipleship was written while the Nazis were coming to power and were in power, but they hadn't gone to war yet, or they hadn't begun the atrocities yet, but they were coming to power. Quote number two, I just want to briefly point that one out. It's really fascinating. He says that he actually gets along better as a Christian with people who are not religious. He says, I often wonder why my Christian instinct frequently draws me more towards non-religious people than towards the religious. And I'm sure it is not with missionary intent. Instead, I'd almost call it brotherly instinct. While I'm often reluctant to name the name of God to religious people, because somehow it doesn't ring true for me there, and I feel a bit honest saying it. It's especially bad when other people start talking in religious terminology. Then I clam up almost immediately and feel somehow uncomfortable and in a sweat. Yet on some occasions with non-religious people, I can speak God's name quite calmly, as a matter of course. And this is why he says this is. There might be other psychological and spiritual things going on with him, but this is his reason why. Religious people speak of God at a point where human knowledge is at an end, or sometimes when they're too lazy to think further, or when human strength fails. Let me just explain what he means there. Usually, and this is the case even in our society, we find God at the margins of our existence. When do people turn to God? When somebody's dying, when somebody's sick, when life is out of our control. Another example is in science. Somehow, and this is the case with my students, if you believe in the theory of evolution, then you can't believe in God, because God can't have anything to do with evolution. Once we've explained something using science or political theory or something else, then God can't be a part of it. God is at the place where we can't explain. That's what people think, and that's what he sees people thinking, that Christians are finding only God only on the margin. Only in those places where we can't explain it or control it. Bonhoeffer says no. God is right in the center of our lives. God is right in the center of everything that is going on. So in the case of evolution, God is right in the center of evolution. How? Well, we're not exactly sure. But God is working in and through that. If you're interested more in that, you can explore the theories of process theology. That's exactly what they do. They find God in the center. Of all these things we think we can explain, God is at the center. In the midst of our health, God is at the center. In the midst of the good times, God is at the center. That's where he wants to find God. Not that God isn't in the marginal places too, but for him, what is happening with these religious people is they just want to put God in those places where humans can't go anymore and let humans do all the work in the middle. He wants to say, no, God is in the middle of everything. And so that's why he doesn't like being around religious people. I also think it's because his family wasn't very religious and he's just not very comfortable with it. And the people he was working with in the conspiracy were not very religious. They were good people and they were concerned about what was happening, but they weren't really religious. And he felt like he could relate to them better. So he goes on to say, I like to speak of God not at the boundaries, but in the center. Not in weakness, but in strength. Thus not in death and guilt, but in human life and human goodness. Those two quotes, one and two, were written April 30th, 1944. They're two sections. He started a letter, stopped, started it again the next day to finish it. And so they're in two different sections of the same letter, so to speak. But it's obviously stopped for a while and then came back. The third one, I'm not going to read all of it, but it's a beautiful quote. Bethke's son was baptized while Bonhoeffer was in prison. In fact, Bethke was married while Bonhoeffer was in prison. And Bonhoeffer wrote a sermon, but he couldn't attend, so he just mailed it to Bethke. But at the baptism of Bethke's son, Bonhoeffer had written this very lengthy letter to the son. And this quotation explains, I think, in much further detail what he's talking about, what needs to be let go. So if you go down about three sentences, he says where it starts, "But we too are being thrown back all the way to the beginnings of our understanding. What reconciliation and redemption mean, rebirth and Holy Spirit, love for one's enemies, cross and resurrection, what it means to live in Christ and follow Christ, all that is so difficult and remote that we hardly dare speak of it anymore. In these words and actions handed down to us, we sense something totally new and revolutionary, but we cannot yet grasp and express it. This is our own fault. Our church has been fighting during these years only for its self-preservation, as if it were an end in itself. Sometimes I wonder if, in fact, that's not what is happening. That if not larger denominations, at least individual congregations are fighting for their own self-preservation, when in fact it might be time to let go and to move into a new form of being a community. And has become so incapable of bringing the word of reconciliation and redemption to humankind and to the world. So the words we used before must lose their power. Be silent. And we can be Christians today in only two ways: through prayer and in doing justice among human beings. All Christian thinking, talking, and organizing must be born anew, out of prayer and action." Sounds a little bit like liberation theology. Those of you know Gustavo Gutierrez. By the way, he read Bonhoeffer's stuff. And there's also some indication that Martin Luther King Jr. read Bonhoeffer's stuff, which is really fascinating because given Bonhoeffer's experience in Harlem and what he saw in the African-American church there, then he goes back to Germany, experiences what he does there, then here's the civil rights leader of the 1950s reading this guy in Germany who was influenced by African-American churches in the United States. It becomes full circle. How much King read, we're not sure. Not maybe that much, but certainly King was influenced by Gandhi, and I have no doubt he had read at least some of Bonhoeffer's stuff. I think I'll stop there. But basically, he goes on to say that things are changing, and the day will come when we'll need to speak the word again, but in a new way, using non-religious language. Non-religious language. Not exactly sure what that means. He's not sure what that means. He writes to Beth, he's saying, "I'm not exactly sure what the heck I'm talking about here. I'm trying to work this out. I have no idea where this is headed, but I just know that something is changing and the church is changing." Quote 5, he talks about being a Christian is now being different. He says, "Being a Christian does not mean being religious in a certain way, making oneself into something or other, like, for example, a sinner or a penitent or a saint, but rather it means being human. Being Christian means being human, as God has created us to be and as Christ has reconciled us to be. It means sharing in God's suffering in the worldly life, not thinking first of one's own needs, questions, sins, and fears, but allowing oneself to be pulled into walking the path that Jesus walks." That's what being a Christian means for him. And then the last quote number 7, I just want to mention this. The conclusion. This is basically the conclusion to this book that he wanted to write, that obviously he never did. This is the final thing he has to say about what the church is. He says, the church is church only when it is there for others. As a first step, it must give away all its property to those in need. How many of your congregations would be willing to sell all of their property and give the money to those in need? And then you gather. He didn't believe that Christians wouldn't gather. They would gather in what was called, why can I never remember this word? It's a Latin word. It's kind of a mysterium group where those who basically followed Christ would gather for prayer, for worship, for hearing the word, for mutual support. And it was, I don't want to use the word secret organization in that nobody else could get in, but it was more hidden. It was a chance for Christians to come together and support each other, but it wasn't about going out and saving the heathen. What the way the church worked in the world was through Christians going out and doing justice, not proselytizing. He goes on to say the church must participate. Oh, the clergy must. Here, anybody clergy in here? The clergy must live solely on the free will offerings of congregations. Whoa. And perhaps be engaged in some secular vocation. The church must participate in the worldly tasks of life in the community. That's what he means by church. Suddenly, they're not churches on every corner. Suddenly, church becomes small groups of people who gather to support each other and then go out into the world to do justice. Then there's not all the infighting about stained glass windows and carpet and whether we have flags up on the altar or, you know, all the things that congregations seem to want to fight about. There isn't any of that anymore. You worship, you pray, something very similar to what we do here at Holden, although I'm guessing they might argue about it once in a while too. But, you know, there's no worship wars. You simply do that and focus on serving. I have a little timeline there at the end. I won't read through it, but you can read through that on your own. Basically, as for the last session, we are ending with Bonhoeffer having been killed and wasn't able to finish any of this. Those of us who study Bonhoeffer, and even those who don't, wonder, where would he have gone? What would he have done? How would he have participated in the reconstruction of Germany? Given that he was seen as a traitor in his country, even by those who weren't Nazis, at least for the first about 5 years after, we don't know. We don't know if his voice would have been heard. But fortunately, he had friends and family who were able to save his words and save a lot of his works that we are still able to. Thank you very much for all of you.